PPI.org.
Thank you for listening to Disability and Progress or joining us. We bring you insights into ideas about and discussions on disability topics. My name is Sam. I'm the host of this show. Thanks so much for tuning in. Charlene Dahl is my research team. Hello, Charlene.
Good evening, everybody.
Annie Harview Engineers. Thank you, Annie. And tonight we are speaking with Peter Altschul. Hopefully I pronounced that correctly again. I'm not sure I can do that two times in a row, who is with us. And we are talking about his book, Riding Elephants, A Creative Common Ground Where Contention Rules. Hi, Peter.
Hi. And you did get my last name correctly. So thank you.
That's yeah. Okay. I'll try to let it happen again. All right. So Peter, I want to start out a little bit by getting some history about you and how you decided to become a writer.
I never thought I'd be a writer. I never enjoyed writing in school or in college. It was one of those things I had to do, you know, to get the job done in one way or another. And back in about 2005, I went to get my fifth guide dog at Guiding Eyes for the Blind in Yorktown Heights, New York. Mm-hmm. And back then, of course, there were no blogs. So what I did every day is I went upstairs and I typed an email sort of summarizing what was happening and what I was thinking and feeling. And I sent it off to probably 50 people every day for like 2 weeks. And when I got home, I called all my contacts and they said, and I to find out how things were going and, you know, to get back to the swing of things regarding work. And they all said, hey, this was a great blog. You should write a book. And I thought they were crazy and sort of and then when I moved to Columbia, Missouri, my wife read them and said, hey, you should write a book. And I thought she was crazy. And they said, well, why don't you take a nonfiction writing course? And I don't even know what a nonfiction writing course was. I'd never taken a creative writing course. Mm. And she said, well, there's this course that the University of Missouri is putting on for graduate students. Why don't you apply for it? And I thought, okay, I'll apply for it. I won't get in, and that'll be the end of the conversation. So, I applied. I sent samples of my writing, which was primarily business writing, because I'd done a lot of written reports. And mm-hmm. Much to my shock, I was accepted. And this was a PhD level writing course that I never should have gotten into, you know, but I was accepted. And the professor was a fabulous editor. I learned so much from her about how to write in English and not businessese or legalese or bureaucraties. And, you know, and that's when I started writing the first book, which is the memoir, Breaking Barriers, Working, Loving While Blind. And then the rest is sort of history.
Mm. Tell me a little bit about that book. Because that's not the one I saw, but I am curious about it.
Well, Breaking Barriers is a memoir. And it's actually based on those blogs that I talked about earlier. I sort of used those blogs as a starting point for the memoir. And the book sort of talks about my time at Guiding Eyes and at home with Jules, the new dog, mm-hmm. and goes from there to getting married in Columbia, Missouri. And during that time, my stepmother died and my father died. And of course, when you're going through a major changes like that, you reflect on what's happened in your prior life. So I write a lot about those reflections. Mm-hmm. And I also write a lot about what made Guiding Eyes such an effective organization, and that what other businesses and organizations can learn from Guiding Eyes. My background is in organization behavior. So this gave me an excuse to write about that, as well as my life history. So that's what it's about.
Excellent. All right. Well, thank you very much for that explanation. I want to talk about the book that we're here to talk about tonight, Riding Elephants, Creating Common Ground Where Contention Rules. Yeah, how did you get the name for that book?
Thank you. It's a two-part story. So there is a book called The Righteous Mind by a political writer named Jonathan Haidt, H-A-I-D-T, which came out in 2012. And the book does lots of interesting things, but for the purposes of this conversation, he has this idea of elephants, the image of an elephant being our feelings. And we, as the elephants riders, have to learn how to control our feelings put them to good use. And so that's where the riding elephants came from. And I wasn't sure if I was going to use that as the title. But then when I started circulating some articles around my friends and my communities, I started getting calls from people saying, hey, this image is really cool. We're using it in our conversations a lot. And I thought, oh, well, if they're using it, then maybe I should put that in the title. So that's the riding elephants part. The creating common ground where contention rules comes from my second book. So when I was getting ready to publish my second book, which is another earlier group of essays, the publisher said, what would you say your life theme has been that it's small enough that you could put it on a banner? So it has to be small and memorable. And I'm not really fond of writing those kinds of things, but I thought about it. And most of my professional life and even my personal life has been around the issue of creating common ground. You know, how do you work with people who have differing experiences or backgrounds or histories to create that common ground where contention rules. Contention, of course, is another word for conflict. And I kind of like the alliteration, creating common ground where contention rules. And so that's where both parts of that title came from.
Excellent. Well, I should have you come to my house. I have a teenager. There's a lot of conflict.
I have some sympathy.
Sympathy is right. I want to ask you about a couple quotes or comments in your book that you have. I'm curious. One of them is, I remind myself that my goal is not to win the argument, but to state clearly what I believe and why. Talk about that purpose of stating your opinion then.
Well, especially when I'm working with people who I have differing perspectives and political beliefs than I do, I don't think it is my role to change somebody's mind. First of all, it's not likely to happen. You know, when you have a strong belief about something, it's not going to change based on one conversation. It really is not, and it's made my life a lot easier and made the pressure on me less daunting when I'm having these conversations. My role is just to be able to communicate what I believe and why. That's hard enough as it is. And then how it influences that other person, I have no control over that. I really don't. And it's been very liberating for me when I remember that when I'm having these conversations. You know, my job is to communicate as clearly as I can. And that's it. That's the end of my responsibility.
So in your experiences, though, what does make a person change their mind if they change it?
When we're talking about these contentious issues like abortion or race relations or, you know, gun control or all those issues that we are, usually those hot topics, those culture war topics are bound with how you were raised and experiences you had in your life. And the only way that's going to change is if you have a really significant experience. So, for example, with the area of gun control, maybe you are anti-gun control, but then a friend of yours gets shot with an illegal gun. Mm. Well, that might get you to thinking, okay, maybe there's something, you know, that maybe my opinion might change a little bit. And I should also say that it might not change fully. In other words, I might still be anti-gun control, but not as strongly. Or I believe there are certain circumstances when gun control might be a good thing. You know, I might not change totally, but I might change a little bit. And that itself is a major accomplishment. I write about the book about the idea of a spectrum or a continuum, where you start on one end where you're very powerfully in one direction. At the very end, you're very much at the other, you know, at the other end. But most of us aren't on either end. We're in the middle somewhere.
Usually.
And so people sort of move up and down the spectrum based on experiences and conversations that we have.
So you yourself, though, have you had experiences that have really changed how you felt when you started out one way?
Not fully, but one of the things that I did, which is one of the most interesting professional experiences I had, was working with pro-life and pro-choice activists. I'm not talking about the run-of-the-mill people, but folks who really were strongly on one side of the issue or another, bringing them together to have conversations. And when they could agree on something, to have them work on issues that were related to abortion. So it might be teen pregnancy prevention. It might be adoption. It might be making the language less inflammatory. It might be a number of things. But I'm still pro-choice, but I now have much more empathy for where the pro-life folks are coming from. And I am not quite as doctrinaire on the pro-choice issue as I used to be. I still have problems with the pro-life position, but I am much less doctrinaire on the topic. And after doing that, having that experience, working with the folks on both sides, it's helped me sort of rethink a lot of my issues. You know, that what I've learned is that there are plenty of, you know, well-meaning, good people on the other side of an issue that I like those people and I respect them. I just don't agree with them. And that's been a very powerful lesson for me that I often forget to my detriment. But when I remember it, it really does help. And
we probably all do, actually.
Yeah, of course.
One of the other things is you say, I remember that greater differences can exist greater differences can exist among groups.
Within groups.
Groups and among groups. So what's the difference with that? Explain that one.
If you talk about, talk about disability, right? Mm-hmm. I'm totally blind. I was totally blind since birth. Yet there is a lot of disagreements among the blind, the disability community and all kinds of stuff.
Whether it be political,
whether it be, ethics, whether it be how we conduct our lives, what our values are, techniques. Yeah, there's all kinds of differences. And we sort of forget that there's a lot of differences within our community. And sometimes they're different. They're greater than the groups that aren't disabled, you know. And that's really helpful for me because, you know, when I'm working with people with disabilities, if I remember, hey, we don't always agree on stuff, it makes me a little more careful about how I frame an issue because I may be talking to someone who totally disagrees with me. I don't know. So I try not to make as many assumptions as I used to. And it's true for all groups. It's true among women. It's true among people from other underrepresented groups. It's true of, fill in the blank.
Yeah.
Fill in the blank.
I remember thinking I was very wise many years ago, and I confronted a militant blind person and said, you know, if instead of being broken up into different blind groups, if we all kind of band together and just supported the different things we wanted and agreed that the other ones wouldn't rebel against those things, we'd probably get a lot further. And she looked at me and said, and that will never happen.
Well, and that's too bad. And from my perspective, that's too bad. Because
yes, that's exactly what I said. It's like, that's really sad because you will always be the weaker link. We will always be weaker apart rather than together.
Right. And by the way, this happens in every group, you know, and I write about this in the book, you know, it does. If you're a Christian, if you're Jewish, if you're an athlete, if you're, you know, fill in the blanks, it happens with every single group. And if we can remember that there's a lot of differences within our groups, and they're sometimes a lot greater within than among groups, it really makes a difference in how you have these conversations.
Yes. I want to ask you about another thing that I found interesting in the book. You said, think about how creating common ground doesn't mean you can't have strong opinions, and doesn't mean you'll always meet in the middle. So if you can't meet in the middle, how does one move forward?
Well, let me talk about my work with the pro-life and pro-choice activists.
All right.
They never changed their views one iota on abortion. They're either really strongly pro-choice or really strongly pro-life.
That's right.
And they had very interesting conversations. Sometimes they were contentious. Sometimes they were quiet and low-key. It depended on the group. It depended on lots of things. But the question was, okay, what are things that we can work together on that are abortion related, that we can live, that we're comfortable with, you know, without changing our views? We're not, you know, we always said to the groups, we're not asking you to change your views on abortion. We want you to understand what the other thinks and feels, but we're not asking you to change your views. But what are some of the issues that you all can work together that are abortion related? And what we found among many of these groups is that there are three issues. I think I mentioned them a little bit before. One of them was teenage pregnancy prevention. Nobody wants teenage pregnancy, you know, unplanned pregnancies. So what are some things that the community can do and the parents can do and whoever can do to make teenage pregnancy less likely, right? What are some, and so they, we got some funding to do some work together on that topic. I spent a year in Glendale, Arizona doing just that, based on the group that was working there. The second issue was adoption. You know, adoption is a complicated issue, but both groups saw that there really might be some work they could do together to encourage adoption, or at least make it more understandable to a lot of folks. People don't sometimes understand the complexities of adoption and what it means. And so that was the second issue. And the third issue, and this was back in the late 90s when things were really contentious, was to tone down the language and not to use those hot button words that both sides, primarily the pro-life side, but also the pro-choice side, were using to label, you know, the other side.
Right.
That was really destructive. And those three topics were huge. And the fact that they could work on those topics without, you know, changing their views and being able to talk about those views, continue it, really was a very powerful experience for everybody involved, including me. So, and so the same thing applies to every other group in the universe, you know, the pro and anti gay rights, you know, there are things that they can work on. The whole race relations thing, there are issues that can work on. You know, and you know, pick a contentious issue, gun control. You know,
there's so many now.
You could find those sort of overlaps that both groups could work on, and of course, that takes some time to get there. You know, because groups have to trust each other, and it's a long, you know, it's a complicated process.
Yes.
Anyway, so that's sort of answers your question. You know, and sometimes it does mean meeting in the middle. Sometimes it means, you know, horse trading, and it means, okay, you know, I'll give you this if you give me that, you know, kind of thing. Then that's a perfectly valid approach sometimes, right. But it's not always. That's not even most of the time, I don't think.
So you talk about riding elephants. Explain the term elephants pertaining to this book.
Right. So elephants are feelings. And the research indicates that it's the feelings that generate the energy, not the thought. So I'll give you an example, right? A thought is, I like pizza, right? Mm-hmm. Pizza's good. And we might disagree on the flavors, but I like pizza. Well, if I'm hungry, that's a feeling. That's going to have a different impact than if I'm full. Or if I'm relaxed, it might have a different reaction than if I'm stressed out and I want to eat comfort food, right? Mm-hmm. Hungry, stressed out is a feeling. It's those feelings that generate the energy. It's not the thought. It's the feelings behind the thought that generates the energy. And so we can all become better elephant riders, feelings. Steerers, if you will, so that we can use those feelings to a good end.
So this kind of leads into the discussion that you have about thought channels and feeling channels to me.
Which
feels so much like right now our political system. There's definitely these thought people when it came to at least the virus, mm-hmm. and these feeling people. And do you want to talk a little bit just about that whole concept of thought channels and feeling channels?
Yeah. So let me back up a little bit. So have you ever been in a situation, and I asked the audience this as well as the hosts, where you're working with somebody and you really are trying to have a conversation and you really are trying to make things work out, whatever it is, and it's not working?
Right.
It happens with spouses quite often. Mm. Or it happens between bosses and employees. It happens between parents and children. And you're having this conversation and you're doing everything you can to make it work and it's not working. Well, why is that? Why? Well, there are lots of reasons why it is. But one of the reasons is that one person is talking thought language and one person is talking feelings language. And the way this often comes out is you have a person from an underrepresented group, let's say women, who are just totally frustrated about something, you know, and they're just venting and they're venting a whole lot of feelings about whatever the situation is. Mm-hmm. And the other person, often white men, are talking about how to solve the problem. Well, solving the problem is a thought. It's a thought channel. And unless you can connect with the feelings channel of the person who's expressing that frustration or that irritation or that joy, whatever it is, unless you can connect with that feeling, you are not going to communicate with that person effectively. It just is not going to happen. Not only are you not going to be able to communicate effectively, if you continue along this line, it's going to get worse and worse, and it's going to get more and more frustrating for everybody involved. And so that's really what we're talking about here, you know. And I write about how I used to run co-lead week-long team building seminars with complete strangers. And this happened at least once in every session. And, you know, and then people would sort of notice, okay, we're not communicating effectively. What's going on? And the guy who ran the show, Dr. Kenneth Soule, would say, hey, there's a feelings channel, there's a thought channel. And the other thing that I should say about this is it doesn't mean you need to spend equal time on both channels. Sometimes all it takes is to share a story that's connected to the conversation. Because stories, a really good story connects on both channels. Or it may just mean saying, hey, I'm enjoying this conversation. You know, how are you doing? You know, just to connect with the feelings. Or this is so frustrating, right? Frustrating is a feelings word. Or, you know, something that shows the other person that you're connecting on the feelings channel. Sometimes it's all it takes.
Does also like lining the thoughts concept up with a feeling concept, does that help both sides?
Yes, but the point is, yeah, absolutely. But again, feelings are the things that drive the energy. It's not the thoughts. Mm-hmm. So if you connect with that energy, and that's getting back to the abortion issue, for example, that's a lot what happened. The trusting is a feeling, right? Trust. And so once people begin to trust each other and feel more relaxed around each other and grow that respect that they didn't have before, then all of a sudden the ways of working together came out. But it didn't come out until that there was enough trust and enough relaxation around the other for those things to happen.
So this leads me into another concept you talk about, which is trash talk and trust talk.
Same basic idea. So trash talk, we all know what trash talk is, right? We experienced it. And anybody who has been around athletes, stepson recently graduated from college, and he was on a scholarship as a college football player, and he spent a bunch of his time trash talking the opponents. Mm-hmm. You know, and the way I define trash talk is making ourselves feel better by saying nasty things about them. It's all about us and them, right? Making ourselves feel better by demeaning the other. That's what trash talk is. And there's I am not against trash talk. There is a place for trash talk. In fact, I'd make the argument that Jesus used trash talk when he criticized the religious leaders and the government leaders of his time. He said all kinds of nasty things about the Pharisees and Sadducees and things. And he did it, I think, in part to encourage his apostles and those following him, disciples. I think that's in part why he did it. Now, I am not a theologian, and I'm sure I'll get some pushback by folks who are theologians, but it seems to me, I don't see how you can not interpret what he said as trash talk. You hypocrites, you corpses, he says some fairly harsh things right. about these leaders. And anyway, so that's trash talk.
I always feel like there's a difference in trash talk and joking and trash talking to be mean.
Well, but that's an interesting example. Let me come back to that for a second, but let me talk about trust talk first. Mm-hmm. So trust talk is essentially lowering those barriers and doing things so you can share experiences and feelings and stories and whatever. So you can build that trust, that feeling of trust, to build that positive energy between you and them. And that's what trust talk is. I make a reference to a Taylor Swift song, which I give a link to, which I'm drawing the blank for the name, but she does a wonderful job in that song, Trashing Trash Talk. It's really quite funny. It's a terrific song of hers. If you can tolerate Taylor Swift, I encourage you to listen to it. It's in the book, and I can't remember what the song is called. I'm drawing a blank. Anyway, so let's talk about the joke situation, because jokes can cut either way. And sometimes it's hard to tell.
That's true.
Sometimes it's hard to tell which is trust talk and which is trash talk. So let me tell you what happened to me, what prompted me to write that essay in the first place. I belonged before the virus hit to the praise band. I was the drummer in our church's praise band. Mm-hmm. And we were coming back after the sermon to play again. And the minister was preaching. And for those who don't know, we drummers sit on what we call a drum stool or a throne, and the drum stool can swivel. So I was sitting on this drum stool, and I hadn't sat properly. So I tried to swivel so I could be sitting in the right, facing the right direction. And the stool made this huge squeaking noise, just this mammoth, gargantuan squeaking noise right in the middle of the minister's prayer. And the minister said, "Excuse me," and I said, "Oh, sorry," and so that was that. On the way home, the bass player said to me, "Hey, you need to cut back on your butt. You have a big butt. You need to cut back on your butt." And I knew that this is how this thoughts and feelings things work. I'd known this guy for a year. He was a terrific guy. Mm-hmm. And I really genuinely think he was trying to do the trust talk thing. He was trying to empathize in a funny way. But it was so embarrassing. Notice embarrassing feeling. It was so mortifying that I couldn't accept it that way. And it's not that we didn't like each other. We still liked each other. But I couldn't quite see the humor in it at that moment. And so that was sort of trash talk. But it's sort of I know he meant it well, right? But at that moment, it felt more like demeaning than
hurtful. Supporting. Yeah.
Sometimes it's hard to tell, but we know for the most part when we're trash talking, when we're trust talking.
Right.
We know what they're, and sometimes we're not sure. And when that happens, sometimes we apologize, and sometimes the folks who've experienced this sort of come to realize that it was meant in good faith. And then you say, "Hey, I know you meant this in good faith. I just wasn't ready to hear it," which is what I told the bass player later on.
Right.
I know you meant this for good, but he got it, and we moved on with our lives, and that was it. But this stuff happens all the time, in small ways.
I'd like to talk about another term that you have in the book called Rubber Band Rhetoric.
Yeah. Now, rubber band rhetoric is a concept with groups. And think about a rubber band. I love playing with rubber bands as a kid, you know, because you could stretch them and you could get different sounds of them, and you could stretch them and then you could, you know, let them go back to normal with a snap, you know, and a thwunk, as I call it in the book. Mm-hmm. And groups are sort of like rubber bands, and they're constantly expanding or contracting their boundaries based on whatever the situation is. And the example I give in the book is when I was in high school, I was the only blind person in the high school I attended, and I ran with the musicians and the athletes. And I was a reasonably smart kid, but I couldn't like totally acknowledge that with those kids, because then I'd be considered an egghead. This is high school politics, right? As an egghead and not as a cool guy who likes sports and music. The two didn't connect always in high school, at least not in high school I went to.
Yeah.
So I applied to Princeton University as a senior, but I didn't tell any of my friends until I got in. And the only reason that they found out is because, you know, the word got around the school and people said, "Hey, Altshul, we didn't know you were that smart." And I sort of chuckled. But that was the persona I was using. And the reason I did that, getting back to the rubber bands, is I didn't want that rubber band, you know, that rubber band barrier, rubber band banner, as I called it, to snap and exclude me, right? You know, that stinging rubber band, you know, if you've been stung by a rubber band, it stings, you know, and I didn't want that. And so every group does this. Every group figures in who's in and who's out, and stretches to do certain things and contracts and expands.
That's so true in high school.
Yeah, well, it's true, but it's true everywhere, right?
It is true everywhere, it feels like junior high and high schools gets all, it's rough in junior high, a little less rough in high school, but still.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. But it's even hard as, you know, it's hard as an adult, right?
Yes.
You know, we as blind people find it hard to get into some of these groups because they're not expanding their rubber band enough. Excuse me. And it's an important concept because we sort of forget that this happens in every group. You know, it doesn't matter what the group is, you know, name the group. Political groups, religious groups, sports teams, you know, hobbies. It's the constant thing. And sometimes it can be healthy and sometimes it is not healthy at all. And then I write about that in the book a little bit.
It feels like you went through and chose every conflict discussion that is really almost current during this time. And what inspired you to write such a book like this?
Well, when I finished my memoir, I was working with a publicist and she said, "You need to start writing a blog." And I said, "Okay, what should I write about?" And she said, "Whatever you want." Well, I have lots of interests. And I said, "Well, what advice do you have for me?" And she said, "Keep each blog under 750 words." And that was the best advice I ever got, because at least I don't know what you think, but I've read a number of blogs and some of them are just so long that I just don't have time to read them. So when I wrote these blogs, I deliberately try to keep these blogs short and punchy so that people could read them, you know, in 5 minutes or less and react to them and then move on with their lives if that's what they wanted to do. And so I started writing blogs and about whatever interested me at the moment, you know, whether it be politics or sports or music or family life or workplace behavior or religious stuff, Christianity, as I call it, rhetorical rabbit holes. Those blogs became the basis for my second book, which is Creating Common Ground. Breaking It Down and Connecting the Dots, Creating Common Ground, Work Intention Rules. And then my current book, Riding Elephants, Creating Common Ground, Where Contention Rules. And the first book, our blogs, essentially I wrote from during President Obama's second term. And the Riding Elephants primarily were written during President Trump's term. And the Riding Elephants starts essentially with Trump's first year of Trump's administration and ends with with President Biden being sworn in. I mean, those are the blocks that it covers. And the book isn't just politics. A lot of it is not. But I'm just trying to describe the years involved that mm-hmm. these blogs were written, the zeitgeist, if you will.
So you do talk about the next concept I wanted you to discuss, which was rhetorical rabbit holes. Tell us about that.
Well, we all communicate. Rhetoric is another way of saying communicate. And there are communication styles and the rhetorical styles and, you know, whatever. But the rabbit holes are things that if we're not careful, we fall down. For those of us who have read Alice in Wonderland, you know, her adventure starts by falling down a rabbit hole. And then she spends the rest of the book trying to get out.
Right.
You know, it's hard to get down. It's hard to get out of the rabbit hole. So that section of the book has a number of essays talking about rabbit holes that I've seen and how we might to avoid them, what we might do to avoid them. And, you know, if we're in them, what we might do to get out of them, you know, things. And so, you know, there are a number of, in that section, I think I talk about race relations. I talk about the speech I would have made if a Supreme Court, certain Supreme Court nominee was being considered. I start the section with a story about my dad. And the story in a nutshell is we were very much, we hated the New York Yankees baseball team. And then it became a year when, and we were Red Sox fans. So we wanted the Red Sox to win and the Yankees to lose. But then there was a year when the Red Sox were competing for a pennant and the Yankees were not. And there are times when the Yankees, if the Yankees beat some teams, it would help the Red Sox. And my dad told me that there are times when you have to root against your enemy, to root for your enemy, the Yankees in this case, so it will help the Red Sox. And that was a sort of mind-blowing concept for me as a 10-year-old kid. You know,
voting for the lesser of two evils.
No, I think it's more than that. I think it's, there really are situations where you really need to, some of the good ideas come from the other side, mm-hmm. Good ideas can come from anywhere. But if you're not open to that possibility, you lose a lot of good ideas. And that was sort of, my dad was saying, hey, there are times when you need to root for the Yankees. Well, that for me, that was a mind blowing concept for a 10-year-old kid. And the miracle of the story is the Red Sox won the pennant, you know, and the Yankees lost. So that sort of was what got me started on this sort of common ground journey, that sort of weird, wonderful experience. So that's how that section starts.
What do you want people to take away from your book?
I want people to, hopefully enjoy the book and help them think that there are different ways of thinking about issues. And I hope that people can get the concept that, you know, common ground, creating common ground is possible if we, you know, use our energies to make that happen. Not always, it's not always going to happen, but it's possible. You know, all the work I've done has been getting people with very differing backgrounds and experiences and cultures to work together to get stuff done. And once, if you can get those groups to do it, to work together, lots of amazing things can happen. And I give as an example the whole Dr. Martin Luther King thing. I mean, he brought together people from all different backgrounds to deal with race issues and making mm-hmm. integration, all that stuff. He brought people from all walks of life, mm-hmm. you know, and they learned to work together, even though they disagreed on lots of stuff. And the really good leaders can do that kind of stuff. I think about guide dog schools is the other example that comes to mind. For those of us who have been to get a service dog, you're with people who you haven't met before, often who come from very different backgrounds, different ages, different genders.
Oh, that is so true.
And the genius of the schools is they have figured ways of getting people to work together so we can each learn to be better dog handlers. And nothing's perfect. I mean, every person who's gone to a guide dog school or service, we'll talk about examples of things falling apart. And right. every employee of a guide dog school will share horror stories. So this is not perfect, but it works far more often than not. And the reason is, in part, because everybody understands what the mission is, right? It's a very clear mission. We're all there to learn to be better dog handlers, to put it in the broadest possible terms. And with that mission, a lot of these differences, even though they're important, are far less important. So that's a long-winded answer to answer your question. I really hope that people, that the book helps them think, supports them in thinking a little bit differently. And it conveys the idea that you really can find that common ground or create it if you do certain things a certain way.
But you gotta wanna.
You have to wanna, and you have to expect that it won't be successful. You know, as I said, you're not gonna change somebody's mind on a culture war issue with just one conversation. It just isn't gonna happen. And you may never change somebody's mind. But that doesn't mean that you can't work together on issues that are related to that topic or on other issues, you know. So that really is the point. And some of the essays are funny. I hope some of them make you laugh. Humor is a laughter is a feeling, you know. Some of them hope make you think. Some of them are in the middle, you know. So and it's the kind of book where you don't have to read it cover to cover. You can pick up the book, read a few essays, put it down, pick it up and read a few more. You know, it's not one of these books that you have to read, you know, conscientiously from cover to cover. You can pick and choose. You know, read the prologue, which is what we've been talking about.
Yes.
And then read the rest of the book, because the rest of the book are based on various themes, whether it be, business behavior or rhetorical rabbit holes or culture war issues or Christian and Christianity or pandemic times. That's the last section. I write about, you know, my experience going through what's gone on the past year. So anyway.
I would like to talk a little bit about, in your book, you talk a lot about your musical stuff. You know, you've had a lot of musical experiences. And you talk about artists and you categorize them into either redwoods or chameleons. And I'd like you to expand a little more on that discussion point.
Yeah. So first, I should say that music is one of the best ways to create common ground, right? That's why that section's in there in part. You know, you can't sing in a choir with people and not feel closer, connections with those folks. It's impossible. Doesn't change the world, but it loosens things up a little bit. So redwoods and chameleons. I sort of make the argument that there are sort of two kinds of artists. And one are what I call redwoods, and they're people who perfected a style. And perfected and learned how to play it, learned how to write in it, learned how to communicate it. And the example that comes to mind immediately is B.B. King, you know, blues person. I saw him twice in person before he died. And of course he was a blues expert, but he was also able to communicate his love for the blues. You know, I mean, that's what he lived. And, you know, he was a redwood. You know, he really sort of, you know, he was a blues dude, you know, and of course there are other blues dudes too, but he was the one that I happened to hear. So they're the ones who perfect a style and market it and use it and whatever, and sometimes incorporating other styles into it, but always, you always know it's blues, you know, that's what he did. And a lot of the European classical composers, you know, the symphony, the string concerto, Haydn, Mozart, Beethoven, all those people, you know, build a foundation. Motown music, build a foundation that other people continue to build on. People are still writing symphonies. People are still writing Motown tunes, even now in 2021. The style has changed a little bit. So that's redwoods. Chameleons are people who find a way to incorporate many styles into their music. You know, they don't focus on one style, but they find a way to imprint their personality or their creative genius or whatever onto those styles. So the example for me growing up was the Beatles. I mean, the Beatles started as a standard sort of rock and roll band at the time, and over 7 years transformed into Sgt. Pepper's, just this astounding, you know, music that was so different from where they started.
And they it sure was.
It's just amazing, you know, and they incorporated all kinds of styles, different styles in that music, you know, and the same thing with the White Album. And so what I do is I write about this, and then I list who I think are sort of the Redwoods and the Chameleons of my time.
I see. Now I think I get it. I was like, what does he mean?
Yeah, well.
But I could see how you could place, I think you placed Sting in the Chameleon.
I did.
And he is more like you, he does a lot of different variety, but you know his sound.
Exactly.
You know his style and you know his sound.
Yeah. And yes, I think that's correct. And I put Steely Dan into the Chameleon and Dave Matthews Band. I also put Taylor Swift in the Chameleon, even though I think Taylor Swift is one of those people who
But she's very versatile. She's
very versatile. And you know, you may not like her, but I think she's an incredible talent in that sense. And Imagine Dragons is another one who's morphed into different styles. You know, they started and when now they're in a quite different place than they used to be.
Oftentimes, but not always.
The
Chameleons are the ones that survive because they're versatile.
Often, right. I think they tend to have a longer career. But, you know, you have people like Aretha Franklin, for example.
Ah, yes.
Although Aretha, sometimes it's hard to categorize, you know, some of these things are arbitrary. And I'm sure people, if they read the essay, will say, I think he's wrong. That's fine. If you think I'm wrong, that's terrific. But that was one of those essays I wrote to get people to think, you know, and maybe hear things differently.
What was the most difficult section of this book for you to write and why? I love when I can make a person have some silence.
What you have to remember is that I wrote these blogs when I wanted to write them. So the question is not so much that I wanted to write these blogs. The question was for me, what to leave in and what to leave out, to quote a Bob Seger thing. And there were some sections that were harder to decide than others. And the section that I think comes to mind that perhaps is the most controversial is Christians and Christianity. I say some things in that are going to be very controversial for certain folks of the Christian heritage, Christian faith. I won't go to that here. But I really thought through about, okay, do I really want this to be in? Is this conveying the message I want to convey? You know, so it's a question of what, you know, and so those articles that are there, I really try to convey the message is this is what I believe. And there are other ways, I know there are other ways looking at it, and I hope that we can find ways to work together, kind of thing. But all those essays, I didn't have trouble writing because I wanted to write them. That's what I was thinking of at the time when I wrote them, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I like, it feels like some of the jargon or topic, you know, the things that you use to describe things can line up so much with, you know, describing people in the political arena. Mm-hmm. One of the ones you used are fans and fanatics. So, can you kind of compare that? And do you feel like that is a lot of the political arena?
Yeah, I absolutely do. So a fan is just your run-of-the-mill fan. You root for a team, but you don't take it quite as seriously. You know, you might take it seriously on, like, for example, when the Kansas City Chiefs played in the Super Bowl. You know, I might have been a fanatic that particular day, you know, because we wanted the Chiefs to win. But when the Chiefs lost, which they did last year, you sort of mourn for a couple of days and then you go on with your life. Well, fanatics are people who are fanatics all the time. You know, their side is always right. Your side is always wrong. Your side only deals rationally. Their side is totally irrational. You know, you've heard this stuff.
There is no meeting in the middle.
There is no meeting in the middle. But what, as I say in the book, there are fanatics on every side of every issue. You know, it doesn't matter what the issue is. We all are wired sort of the same way. Feelings, not thoughts, drive action. Doesn't matter who you are. And and the fanatics, I think, is what's going on politically. I agree with you. It's hard to create that common ground when people are so. It's a cultural thing, you know.
It seems like it's getting more so.
Well, that's what I'm afraid of. And one of the things, getting back to the abortion work I did, it was difficult for folks to communicate across that the pro-life, pro-choice barrier. But in some ways, it was harder for them to go back to their groups and say, hey, this is what I'm doing. It's pretty cool. Because they were viewed as traitors. How dare you talk to the other side?
Right. And which is a total collapse in any type of mediation or anything.
Anything. That's exactly right. Same thing happens with divorce, right?
Right.
And contentious divorces. How dare you talk to the other person, you know? And it's wildly destructive. And this is what's going on, I think, in the political thing. And as I write at the end of the book, the only way this is going to change, I think, is if it's done from the bottom up, you know, that we as individuals can try to do a better job of reaching out to folks we don't agree with, and not to change their minds, but to support each other as we can, you know.
But I also think that if you stop supporting what you know, the parts that you know are wrong, they won't have the support of those parts they need. I don't know. I worry because I think you always kind of have to have some on each side that can do a little bit of the walk that you're talking about, right, to be able to meet somewhere. But if you really don't, if you have some on one side and none on the other, or whatever that is, or not enough on either side, then, and people are scared to even talk to the other side, that's when you are in trouble.
That's correct. And when we did the abortion project, we made sure that there was an equal number of folks in both sides, you know, to have these conversations. And we did certain other things to make it more likely. One of the things we did is we held these conversations behind closed doors, right? Because we wanted confidentiality to be respected, because otherwise nothing, you know, you can't have these conversations in front of people, you know, it just doesn't work. And, you know, I like to think that maybe some of these conversations about politics are happening behind closed doors and that we don't know about them. I don't have any evidence of that. But neither of us. But it's the only way it's going to happen. It's the only way it's going to happen.
So we're running out of time, but I want just a couple quick things. Is how do you control your elephant?
I list a bunch of things in the book, and one of the things is you mentioned a number of them, you know, already. You know, reminding myself that my goal is not to change my opinion, but to just express mine. The idea of ideas can be built upon ideas. So instead of saying but, I often say and, which I find often change the whole tenor of the conversation. You know, I'm saying, you know, but I say, yeah, and implies, okay, I get what you're saying and I'm trying to build on it. And I think it's a very subtle thing, but it's something I learned from somebody, and it really made a difference in the way I think about things. And there are other things too. You know, I try not to take myself too seriously. I try to remember that I'm often wrong. You know, there are things like that. And it's sometimes really hard to do. You know, I am not perfect. I screw up all the time, but when I'm on, it's a very powerful place to be.
I used to tell my kids when they were little, no buts, that's something you sit on. So, where can people get your books?
They can go to DLD Books, that's David Lenora David books.com/Peter Altschul. That's Peter. And the last name is Altschul. So that's.
We'll try to put that link on our website.
Yeah, that'll be totally awesome. And if you want to get a hold of me, the best way to do that is my email address, which is easier to remember, which is creatingcommonground@outlook.com. And if you want to reach out to me, I'm happy to, you know, to respond, and I'll happy to shoot you the link if that's what you want. So, but it's www.dldbooks.com/Peter Altschul.
Peter, it's been really fun. Thank you very much for shedding so much light on this. And, was a very interesting read. Thank you.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
This has been Disability in Progress. The views expressed on the show are not necessarily those of KFAI or its board of directors. My name is Sam. I'm the host of this show. Charlene Dahl is my research team. Annie Harvey is my engineer. This is KFAI 90.3 FM Minneapolis and KFAI.org. We've been speaking with author Peter Altschul. Peter was talking about his book, Riding Elephants, Creating Common Ground Where Contention Rules. If you want to be on my email list, you can email me at disabilityandprogress@samjasmine.com. Please also look for our podcasts. Thanks for listening. KFAI.org.